the case. Whenever Juji was asked a question, he simply raised one finger. One day, a visitor asked Juji's attendant what his master preached. The boy raised a finger. Hearing of this, Juji cut off the boy's finger with a knife. As he ran from the room, screaming with pain, Juji called to him. When he turned his head, Juji raised a finger. The boy was suddenly enlightened. When Juji was about to die, he said to his assembled monks, "I received this one finger Zen from Tianlong. I used it all my life, but never used it up." With this, he entered into his eternal rest. Umen's comment. The enlightenment of Juji and the boy has nothing to do with the end of a finger. If you can realize this, then Tianlong, Juji, the boy, and you yourself are all run through with a single skewer. Wumen's verse. Tianlong made a fool of old Juji, who cut the boy with a sharp knife. Just as the deity Chu Ling raised his hand and Huashan with its many ridges split into two. So this a fairly dramatic fairy tale. And there are others like this in the koan curriculum. But this imagery of cutting off the finger to save a life. What is so easy to be distracted by the violence of the imagery, that it can be easy to not be able to get quite past that barrier. But in here is the invitation to consider what each of us is willing to sacrifice, what each one of us is willing to endure to truly wake up from this ancient delusion of separation. How might we imagine that Juji's knife is expressing a genuine, heartfelt compassion? In my imagination, the boy has been a student of Juji's for some time. Sitting endless rounds of zazen, working tirelessly in the monastery, dedicated wholeheartedly to cultivating his way-seeking mind, desperate to wake up. And Juji, as his patient and dedicated teacher, guiding and prodding and cultivating and encouraging each step along the way, each moment of dedicated practice, pointing the way and pointing the way, right here, just this, just this, just this. and the boy's puzzled eyebrows. And here is this cultivated ripeness. As this boy monk has entered this place of teetering on the brink, when a visitor comes to the monastery and asks, "What is it that your master preaches?" But not trusting his own heart, not trusting his own experience, scrambling back to what appears to be the safety of his imagination of what it is that his teacher is teaching. Once again, this wonderful boy monk abandons himself, betrays his own wisdom, and holds up somebody else's finger. And Juji hears of this. This final self-betrayal. And he calls for his young student, teetering on the brink. And cuts off his own finger. And as this boy monk runs screaming in pain, all thoughts of anybody else's teaching wiped away, Juji calls to him, and maybe with tears in his eyes, holds up his finger, and there it is, no longer teetering on the brink. Finally, only just this is it. And in this moment, no longer betraying his own wisdom, deep bows of gratitude. And so how does this point to something fundamental about what it's like to be a human being? The ways in which each one of us is inclined to regularly, consistently, chronically, repeatedly betray our own inherent wisdom for the sake of some thought that we have about what should be true, the person that we ought to be, the moment that we should be experiencing. How many years I spent trying to claw through the moment, trying to find some shinier, more luminous moment. One more round of Zazen. If I throw myself into this and stare really hard, maybe I'll see through this to the true way on the other side. Shocking how persistent that dedicated delusion can be. We are committed to the devil we know. And there can be some terror to step away from the familiar pathways of this dark labyrinth of the mind, to leap free of the many and the one. To truly bow and enter just this, only just this, is it. So when we walk in Kinhin, your footsteps, your feet blessing the ground blessing your feet, the wisdom that is arising in your heart, the great way does not enter in through the outside gate. Shine forth your heart and honor the sacrifice of our brother monk, nine-fingered and happy. And so I will pass this on to Diane, who will correct me.
I'd like... I love how James said that we're committed to the devil we know. It is quite a commitment we make. And how do we leap free of that? For me, the most poignant part in this koan is when the attendant, after his finger's been cut off and he's writhing in pain, and he hears the sound of his teacher's voice and he turns toward it. Heartbreaking to me, you know, that even in the face of that violent taking away, instead of running madly from the room, something calls to him, that voice, and he turns toward the voice. So this attendant, who until that moment, he clung to the finger, mistaking it for the real. This clinging is... I think pervasive, and not just Zen, not just Buddhism, but all spiritual practice. There is, in some way, I think that they cultivate, encourage this kind of imitation, and in some ways, right, it can be quite beneficial when one first starts to imitate the forms We bow, we get up when the jiggy rings the bell, we sit down when they ring the bell. We all strive to walk kinhin in unison. The forms call out to us to imitate, possibly. And our teachers from ancient times, from Shakyamuni, from the seven ancient Buddhas, right, offering examples for us to imitate. So how do we discern imitation from the real thing? How do we discern clinging to the finger from what is real? This is like the saying of the Buddha, that not to mistake the moon for the finger pointing at the moon. It's quite difficult, I think, this discernment, and absolutely essential to true liberating practice. This commitment to the devil, we know, you know, is very powerful. John Tarrant likes to talk about how we tend to want to decorate the prison. So we don't want to break free. We just like to make it a little more comfortable, and we are quite good at that, you know. Yeah. So where comes this power, courage, determination, great doubt to question this decorating the prison? What's the difference between imitating and authentically living the life that we've been given so precious? The Sesshin, there's been a teaching from Yamada Kon that I have been sitting with, and I'm finding it very helpful to me. And he said that practice is about forgetting the self in the act of unifying with something. It is forgetting the self in the act of unifying with something. So the young attendant, before he lost his fingers, when he raised his finger, was it the boy raising the finger? Was it different from Juji raising his finger? So, everyone right now, just move your index finger. Now, move. Where's the self in that? Isn't that lovely, right? Just the finger moving. This case also reminded me of a similar case in the Moon and Dewdrop collection, so I'm just going to read it because it's much the same but without the violence. So this is the G version. And it's Zhao Zhou asking the newly arrived monk, "Have you been here before?" And the monk said, "Yes, I have been here." And the master said, "Have some tea." Again, he asked another monk, "Have you been here before?" The monk said, "No, I haven't been here." The master said, "Have some tea." And then the temple director asked the master, "Why do you say have some tea to someone who's been here and have some tea to someone who has not?" The master said, "Director." And the director responded, the master said, "Have some tea." So here, you know, that immediate response, the director turns his head, you know. There, the young attendant, master calls, he turns his head. Such beautiful manifestation of just you lifting your index finger just now. And in this case, there's a poem at the end. It says, "In your picture of the wine shop, who faces you drinking Zhao Zhou's tea?" So when you look in the mirror, who faces you? Who's drinking your tea? Who's eating your rice? So this this great doubt in our chant this morning, calling forward our courage to break our commitment to the devil and ask, who is it? Who is it that's drinking Zhao Zhou's tea?
Andy Warhol, I think, said, artists borrow, great artists steal. So, Juji's finger expressed Juji's faith. And the task of the boy was not to express Juji's faith, but to doubt so very vigorously, to investigate, what is this? Do I see this? And find his own faith. In this way, doubt, questioning, supports true and trusting. There's another koan in the Gateless Barrier. A monk said to Master Yun Men, "The radiance serenely illumines the whole universe." Before he had finished the line, Yun Men interrupted him and said, "Aren't those the words of Chang Shou?" The monk said, "Yes, they are." Yun Men said, "You have misspoken." Then the master asks, another master asks, "Tell me, where did he misspeak?" Our ancestor Keizan says, I think it's Keizan, I'm going to say it's Keizan, speaking of this odd fellow, his true nature, he says, "Sometimes I have him raise the eyebrows and blink the eyes. Sometimes I do not have him raise the eyebrows and blink the eyes. Sometimes raising the eyebrows and blinking the eyes is right. Sometimes it is it. Sometimes raising the eyebrows and blinking the eyes is not it." And so the invitation from, the boy was using his Juji's finger as a crutch. There's an image for you. And Juji took away that crutch. And then the boy had to stand on his own one finger. There's a commercial from like the early 80s, maybe. I think it was for Coke. I remember this. And I think it had Magic Johnson, the basketball player. And like some boy went and was really excited to see Magic Johnson play. And then at the end of the game, the boy was like reaching over, you know, trying to high five Magic Johnson, who just walked on by. And then, the boy looked really sad. And then Magic Johnson turned around and he said, "Hey kid." And he threw him his jersey. And this is how I see Juji. James suggested that maybe Juji was so pained and broken up himself, feeling the difficulty of teaching in such a way that drew forth such great distress from the boy, and called to him. Me, I see Juji twinkling his eyes, completely confident that the kid will see it. Hey, kid, here it is. So, please sit comfortably, be invited into our practice of Dharma dialogue, questions, comments, resonances, fingers.
If you dare.
What you're talking about with the forms and imitating, but we kind of have to rely on them, right? Like, mm-hmm. We can't just be like, oh, I'm just going to figure out the non-separation. Like, we can't actually do that, or it's lost, right? That's not it.
Yeah.
You feel like, oh yeah, this is going to be the non-separation that I'm looking for. Yeah. Like, we kind of have to work with the forms until, like you were saying, you ripen and kind of, I don't know, fall out of the tree? I don't know.
Fall out of the tree, that's right, yeah, there you go. And for me, there's a real experiential difference between sort of chanting the chants without being present, you know, like just being carried along by the momentum of the sangha, and really embodying, you know, each syllable, each word of the chant, you know, really bringing forth your own heart and chanting, you know, your voice, your moment. Yeah. So, you know, these forms. There's a story, and I think it's. I'm gonna not go with Keizan. I'm gonna go with Sungsan. Where once when he was older, you know, might have been the, you know, another monk who had just had a great realization says, you know, why do you bow to the Buddha? You know, why not? You know, like you might as well spit, right? So freeing himself from the forms. Sungsan said, well, you can spit. I will bow.
And so these forms, right, which for me are a beautiful container offering freedom, also the forms and all of Zen is skillful means, right? It is, the Buddha talked about the raft, you know, going across the river, and we don't carry the raft on our back once we get on the other side. So there's no other side to go to, but the analogy kind of falls apart. But just appreciating the beauty of the forms, like a gift, you know, within which we can authentically be our no-self, and also that it's all provisional, you know, it's all somebody. James was joking earlier about these samways that we wear and how they're Japanese jogging clothes. We turn them into something kind of, you know, holy. So, and, you know, make sure we remember that too.
And there's a way too that that there is a quality, a liberating quality, and there is a path of fake it till you make it. And but don't be satisfied with your faking it. Keep investigating. And in a certain way, this is what one of the modes in which koans work in Dokusan. Sometimes we give answers and are completely dissatisfied with the quality of our state of mind as we're giving this answer. Or sometimes we give an answer and we have no idea why that response is relevant. And this is a mode that appears in Karate Kid, right? He's trying to learn karate and all he gets to do is paint the fence and wax the car. Wax on, wax off. But I wanted to learn karate. What am I doing? I'm just doing this. And then all of a sudden he learned. He sees, oh, I've actually been doing this. I've been manifesting this all along. And for me, it wasn't until I was around in the, you know, fourth collection of koans that we studied where I started to understand what any of my previous responses were expressing. And I had great doubt and great frustration at my teacher for accepting my imitation finger. But I was also mistaken about my own imitationness.
Yeah, Justin.
Something that just came up to me in terms of forms and fingers is, you know, the boy was using Juji's form until he had to transcend the form. And so Juji had to cut off that form, but he didn't cut off all of his fingers. He just cut off that one. So cutting off the form as a form while keeping the form as forms.
Yeah. Well, you got it. You mean you have to say something,
yeah,
right? So it has to manifest in some way. And yeah, sort of like Josh was saying, you know, sort of that's, you know, you're relying on that crutch a little bit too much, right? So let's see what, you know, what becomes vividly apparent for you in the absence of that crutch. Yeah. Laura.
Yes. So many great things in this koan, but the things that really caught me today was so easy to put attention on the attendant and thinking of them screaming with the finger, you know, cut off. Mm. And what I really appreciated today was some of the reflections that you all offered about from the teacher's perspective, right? And I love what you said, James, about when you said cutting off a finger to save a life.
Mm.
You know, that seeing that for me in my life, the teachers, however they appear, whether they're human teachers or other kinds of teachers, are are in great love, wanting me to wake up, even when it feels awful.
Mm.
You know, like the cutting off of the finger must have hurt terribly. I know, just slicing my finger with a knife trying to cut carrots feels terrible, right? But this this teacher had such great love for his student and was so like, please wake up inside, right? Please, you know, like he saved his life.
Mm.
From just going through his life daydreaming for the rest of his life, he actually woke him up. Mm. And Diane, when you said about oh no, maybe I've lost track of who said, but anyway, the
I think it was me.
You all said it.
I'm pretty sure it was Kazan.
You all said it in a perfect way. That, you know, that when the teacher called to him, maybe with tears in his eyes, and maybe, all I know what it was, tears in his eyes, and then when you said, Josh, this great faith of the kid's gonna get it.
Yeah.
You know, the kid's like, he's there, he's mm-hmm. gonna see it, and he's like, hey kid, you know, and then, you know, wow. So anyway, I just really appreciate this other way of looking at it.
And I appreciate you naming the multiple perspectives. And as you were talking, I realized there's a third perspective in this koan. It's the visitor who comes to the Zen Center for the first time and says, so what is all this about? And the boy goes, and the visitor slowly walks away. Right. when we have many people in the Sangha give beginning instruction to people who come to the temple, to the sitting group, to the center for the first time, and really important to, in that encounter, not just deliver information, but convey the life of Zen for you, the relevance of this practice, and that is what kind of can connect to visitors coming for the first time.
And just to, for carrying that even further, right, out into the world, into all, in which we're engaged, into all of the heartache out there, you know. So, what's the appropriate response, you know, always being asked of us, and doing our best, like today's chant from the service.
Harry.
A couple of things. First, I remember that Coke commercial a little bit differently. I think it was Franco Harris or Mean Joe Green from the Pittsburgh Steelers. But regardless, there is this moment where, you know, we all know, we saw that commercial so many times. It's like, oh, the shirt is coming the kid's way. What I remember more is a parody where it's a shot of the kid and the bottle hits his head. So, you know, the Coke bottle. So to me, there's kind of an interesting lesson in that. That's what I'll bring to the table. But the this koan and our working on it in the Dharma Dialogue has really struck me very emotionally in a way I've never met a koan. And I can't help but think about the attendant. And if I were that boy for many times, for a long time, I could not get over the fact that somebody cut my finger off. I would not get over that, and I would be stuck with that, despite perhaps even knowing, well, you can have the finger cut off and be mad about it, or you can have the finger cut off and find enlightenment. And that's kind of there. And as I was thinking about that, I realized, like, it's not so much that I'm maybe so deeply involved in the moral outrage of having my finger cut off, but enlightenment, realization, that openness, as I become more, as a friend said to me, you need to be more teachable, as I become more teachable, I think I'm, I'm very scared of enlightenment. I'm very scared of that openness. I'm like, as I approach that, I'm like, well, holy shit, then what? There's a lot there. And as you said, it's like, I came to Zen to learn meditation to calm down. And you guys keep spinning me this other thing. But, you know, but this other thing is the thing that I was looking for. It's just, there's been so much there in the way. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I want to particularly invite people who haven't yet spoken in the Dharma Dialogue to consider putting their finger out there.
I'll say something.
Betty, something.
Yes. Yeah. Well, first, I'm not ready to give up my outrage about the finger being cut off. That's one thought. Because I don't think it was necessary, actually. I don't think he needed the finger cut off to be enlightened. I'm not sure that his response to the outsider was necessarily wrong or imitation. It might have been. It might not have been the most helpful response, given the fact that the person was new and that a finger wouldn't mean a whole lot. Maybe, would you like a cup of tea would have been better. We can talk. I'm still having a hard time with that.
Yeah.
I'm not willing to give up my finger for enlightenment.
Yeah.
And I was kind of just like what Harry was saying, you know. Where are you taking me with this? You know, I'm not ready to go there. Right? That's a really powerful and important place to be, I think.
It's a koan in which a student says to the teacher, I have nothing. What should I do with it? And the teacher says, set it down. And then the student says, but it's I can't set it down. It's nothing. I can't set it down. Teacher says, okay, keep carrying it. And so a lot of outrage arising. That's the mental formation vividly apparent here. How wonderful to see. Ah, outrage. Ah, unwilling. Ah, not at all what I wanted. Well seen.
Yeah, Ray.
I liked what Diane said, the koan about sort of letting go of yourself, but yet moving towards something else. In the Buddhism 101, we've been studying the precepts and talked about renunciation. And it's easy to renounce if you've got something, you know, bigger to that's pulling you, that's calling you to it. And for me, that the same question, like, I'm not ready to you know, stand up and speak. And yet, continuously, the Dharma expresses itself through me. And it has nothing to do with my readiness. You know, and I'm always surprised when it happens, and it's clear it has nothing to do with me. And yet, most of the time when I'm in my own head, I think it has something to you know, to me. And then I'm scared of what if I show up and nothing happens. Then what? You know,
the bottle hits you in the head. The bottle hits you in the head.
Yeah. Right. And yet, for me, it's the trusting in some way the Dharma, the Sangha, the what we take refuge in. And that's what I, as I move towards that of, you know, trusting the practice, then it's sort of like I'm braver in a way to be able to, okay, it's not up to me. And also, I mean, what's wonderful about the practice for me is that I've learned to be able to sit with all of the unpleasant sensations that come up that would otherwise stop me from, you know, oh, it's fear. Oh, mm-hmm. I can sit with fear. It's not, you know, or it's, you know, whatever. I can sit with it and see its true nature.
So, I particularly appreciate the its manifestation has nothing to do with whether I'm ready. Or it's really quite beautiful. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Greg. James.
So I was kind of thinking about the teacher and the attendant is kind of, it was a little, as though it were a little koan presentation in itself, the attendant presenting to the teacher. And it's sort of something I've been thinking about lately is that in my own presentations to my teacher, I think pretty much I started off, you know, parroting what I thought the teacher wanted to hear, and that getting me nowhere. And then I said, well, I need to use my own words. And so I came up with what I thought, this is how James sounds like. These are his words. And maybe sometimes they got me a little farther. What I feel like, though, is that what I'm reaching for, it's not so much what I think my own words are, but what was that vocabulary that I grew up with? The words that, like, my mother and my father taught me. Because I think those words are really if I'm going to express who I express myself, I think it's those words. These words that from El Paso and southern New Mexico and the kinds of parents that I have, that whole realm, I think, is more, that's me. So this is just something I've been sort of toying with. And I've been noticing that those words aren't the kinds of things that I'm presenting often.
I think it's lovely. You know, we talk about the onion and the layers get peeled off, right? And then you go back to the words of your parents. And Zen tells us to go back to your parents before you were born, you know, who are, you know, the face of your parents before you were born. So that, you know, true self, you know, that possibility of that true self manifesting without any need to orchestrate anything. And like Ray was saying, you know, it just doesn't matter, it just appears and it doesn't matter if I'm willing or feel that it's, satisfactory. Yeah.
And there's a way that part of the practice of working with koans is also being able to pour ourselves into the vessels of other beings and let their words and fingers as theirs be ours as ours. So that is another and part of what the value of doing that is that it a little bit helps us flexibly relate to whatever conditioned arisings happen to in some moment or other be vivid for us. And you're right that important to reach into the whole of our being to find the truth of the Dharma.
I feel like yesterday I was encountering this with a lot of confusion, and now like I'm just gonna take it to kind of an uncomfortable place, but I feel like I look at this and I'm a social worker and I see the abuse of a child, and if I were in DCF, Department of Children and Families, and I heard about this Zen teacher, like, cutting off the finger of a kid, and the kid said that he became enlightened, I would think that something is wrong here. And I would, Zen has a history of abuse of power, and genocide, and it just like all other religions, it has a history of that. And I'm having a really hard time using words like intimate to describe this act of violence against someone. And so I don't think I have to, I'm not at a place where I can really be okay with this koan. If I'm gonna take it as it is, it's almost like I have to think it's not true. Like, it's, if I have to think that it's like some kind of exaggerated thing for me to accept this teaching. I can understand what everyone's saying, like what they're getting from this, but it's upsetting.
Yeah.
It's upsetting.
Yeah. And that's, and you're pointing to some super, super important truths. And in a way, I think you're echoing a little bit what Betty brought. And this is why just enlightenment, just oneness is not enough. And this is why we need to constantly be guided and balanced by the precepts. And beyond that, we need to, one of the things that is of great importance is the standards of ethics for a Zen community. And one of James Ford's great gifts to this community was a really lovely framing of kind of ethical practices. It is well worth reading if you haven't read it. It's on all of our websites. Precisely to guard against these abuses of power, these ways that that someone can either intentionally or unintentionally do enormous harm and say, "But I was trying to teach you non-attachment." And this is the MO of the huge sexual predators in Zen. One of whom recently died. So you are also pointing to the necessity of not divorcing this practice from reality, from your heart, from an actual capacity to discern harm. And you're also pointing to the reason why we framed it yesterday as this is a Grimm's fairy tale of a koan, not a news item or a recommendation or a threat to each of you.
And I'll just say, I so appreciate your being cognizant of the form presented by the koans and resisting completely, you know, that I am not going to buy into that. I'm not going to buy into the form of a child abuse in this kind of way, right? So your heartfelt compassion for all children who are abused is what... it is, you know, just streaming forward from you. And I would say, for me, the way I found my way into it was thinking about the ways in which it wasn't Juji who cut off my finger, but it was the universe that came in and, like Rumi's poem, you know, just wrecked everything in my house, you know, nothing less, just took everything out. And in doing so... made possible something else to come in. So in a way, if you can bridge, you know, to your own experience from this Grimm's fairy tale kind of koan, it can be quite helpful, I think.
One other teeny piece that I want to point to. Our Tanto Carol has lovely way of presenting a koan when she forgets the names of the actors in it. She says, "One Carol came in and said," and another Carol responded.
So funny. I'm not sure if it's apropos of anything, but I have a friend who's particularly sensitive to animals. And I have these phrases that I use, like, "There's more than one way to skin a cat," which just... Okay, so I'm, like, on my way into saying that, right? And just veered left. I'm like, "There's more than one way to pet a rabbit." Oh, what time do we want?
one more person who hasn't spoken today or yesterday.
Yeah?
I just wanted, yesterday during the introduction of this being a really violent column, I thought for sure we were going to get the cat.
Yeah, here we go again.
I was like, boy's finger, at least he got enlightened. And then the other thing that struck me today was something Harry said about maybe I don't really want this, which I remember thinking that at one time, and yeah, I still feel compelled to come back to practice. For good or bad, it's never thrown at me anything I couldn't handle.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. So let us return to our upright and dignified posture. Great faith that this will present us with nothing that we can't handle.